Hello and welcome to the Food Connections podcast, the podcast that connects you with the food you eat. I'm Dr. Laura Wynas, a registered nutritionist with an interest in all things related to food and nutrition. Our food story is important to consider as it can help you eat in a more mindful way. As well as thinking about where our food comes from and how it's produced, it's also useful to know more about our food history, our food traditions and family recipes, for example. In this episode, we focus in on breakfast. So, how much do you think about what to have for breakfast? Have you ever considered what your great-grandparents ate and how healthy their breakfast was? And what actually is a healthy breakfast and the benefits of taking your time to have a more mindful meal in the morning? What can we learn from looking back at our food history? Well, in this episode, I'm joined by Peter Gilchrist, Scotland's foremost food historian, specialising in talks and demonstrations that explore the old folk beliefs, forgotten feasts, and the ancestry of food. Writing under the name of Tenement Kitchen, Peter is currently campaigning to have the act of ordering a morning roll registered as a cultural act within the UNESCO UK Living Heritage Inventory. Well, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode that combines mindful eating with taking a look back at the history of our breakfast. Hello and welcome to this episode of Food Connections, and I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Gilchrist. How are you today?
I am wonderful. I can think of no thing I would rather be doing right now than having a chat with you about mindful eating and the history of breakfast.
Absolutely. It's a good topic to discuss. So I wondered if you could start off just by explaining a bit of background about yourself and what life as a food historian kind of looks like for you and where your kind of interest in food history came from.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll start with the story, which is I was a food writer in 2017. And I think like many millennials do, I started a blog, I started taking pictures, started calling myself a food writer, perhaps before I had earned the moniker. And kind of the classic situation that my last grandparent passed away and I inherited cookbooks from her. And in those cookbooks, I found lots of recipes, identical, 13 identical recipes that were in my other gran's cookery book, my other gran that had passed away many years ago before I had even been born. And these two women from opposite ends of Scotland had the same 13 recipes written down in their family cookery books. What actually happened? That was like a moment of questioning. And then the first thing I began to look into was the history of shortbread. I opened up what I came to know as the Glasgow Cookery Book, a textbook from the early 1900s for the Glasgow Dough School, as it was called. And in there, it had a line for shortbread for paisley flour. And as a food writer from Paisley, I suddenly thought, oh, that can't possibly be the same Paisley as the town. And as it came out, corn flour was invented in Paisley. They called it paisley flour. They then wrote hundreds of cookery books trying to sell paisley flour. And all these recipes were named after the gardens I walked in and the villages I grew up in, and for Bray's diamonds and paisley squares. And what I realised after a 1 week of looking into history was that every story I had told about myself of growing up in Paisley was wrong. I have a food story. My community has a food story. Paisley is a place which is rich in food history. I had just never asked the right questions. And overnight, everything shifted. And I thought, I want to have this moment, this eureka moment, as often as I can. And that's when I became a food history addict. Welcome, Tenement Kitchen.
Wow, I did not know about the Paisley flour being corn flour.
It was a shirt manufacturer, a starcher. And they realised, the son of the gentleman, John Polson, who had founded it, realised that it could be food safe. And at the time, like, you have to think about, in the Victorian era, the blancmange, moulded, tasteless glue was the kind of, whatever we got to call it, the entree for popular dining. And corn flour just slotted right in there and was cheap, economical. It was a waste product. But suddenly it kind of took the world by storm and created an entire industry here. And I have lots of kind of shortbread molds that say paisley flour or raisley and all these little bits and pieces of my, like, my hometown ephemera now surround me in my kitchen.
And of course, what Scottish tea break would be complete without a piece of shortbread?
Precisely, precisely. But then actually that was the kind of the part of food history that then opened me up to kind of going, what are all the other food stories that I've been telling myself? Or what are the food stories I see Scottish people telling themselves that with a little bit of questioning, maybe we can unravel a little something more?
Yeah. Well, I want to get onto that and talk about some specific examples, but I thought I might introduce the kind of concept of mindful eating, because it's a concept that when we spoke a few weeks ago, you mentioned about the importance of connecting with the food you eat. And that just also is what this podcast is doing as well, because the whole concept of mindful eating, what food we eat and why we eat it, how we eat it, can help establish healthier relationships with food. Connecting more with the food you eat is one element of that mindful eating. And you've maybe heard of mindful eating before if you're listening to this, but it generally focuses on your eating experience and your body-related sensations and your thoughts and feelings about food, and a kind of heightened awareness of food without judgment as well. So it just brings mindfulness to your food choices and the experience of eating. And from a health point of view and food relationship point of view, it can be really beneficial. But what's your kind of experience or your insights on how useful it is to connect with food emotionally, perhaps?
Yeah, I think every food connection is emotional, whether it is a lack of emotion or an overwhelming amount of emotion. We all eat emotionally. And even if that emotion is about control, we are all engaging with food in different ways. I find my kind of relationship with growing up hearing about mindful eating, it was about things like chewing your food properly, listening to your body's signals to say when it's full, listening to your body when it's craving certain foods or when it wants to. It's listen to your body because it's giving you the indicators for what it needs. What I realized when I started getting into food history, and maybe what I'll preface this as well is say I've my entire life and everyone in my family, our entire lives, we've had a relationship with food. We've had a relationship with weight. And a lot of it for me, I identified as actually just like food insecurity growing up was you didn't always know where the meals for next week were going to come from. And we lived very close to poverty when I was growing up. And the feeling of A, having food in the cupboards, everyone's cortisol was lowered, everyone we could breathe when we had tins, but also the feeling of being full at the end of a meal, regardless of whether you wanted to or not, was like a safety blanket. It was security. And so I grew up deafening myself to all the signals my body was sending me for the purely for survival, purely to feel comfort. So when I get into my late 20s and I'm trying to deal with my relationship with food, I found it really difficult to go through some of the kind of, not the kind of standard ways, but my relationship with nutrition is a treacherous path that I tend to avoid. But what I ended up finding was as I began to get into food history and I was doing research, I realized that lots of the things that I've been doing all my life were rituals that went back hundreds of years. So whether it was something like placing an order for a morning roll, what I was actually doing was expressing food history because the order that I have is the order that my parents have, the order that my grandparents have, and I would imagine their order as well. The types of rolls that they ate growing up in Paisley are the same rolls that my dad ate, the same rolls that I eat. And it's though when you begin to understand that everything from making a cup of tea to your order at your local cafe to eating porridge, these are all things that actually, if in a moment we can realise everyone in my family chain has done this, everyone in Scotland has done this, we've had what shortbread looked like today, we've had it for at least 400 years. So for 400 years, Scottish people have stood over a bowl, rubbing butter into flour and stirring in sugar. And if in that moment I can see it as a ritual that I'm participating in, it can ground me in a way that is both very safe for me to begin to feel mindfully about the food that I'm putting into my body, but also treating it with ceremony, which is, I think, another method for that mindful eating, where actually, if you can center yourself and be cognizant of what you're doing, you can listen to your body's signals and you can begin to esteem yourself through the things that you're doing all the time, but recognizing them as something that can make you feel Scottish.
Yeah, thinking about past generations doing the same in the kitchen, rubbing in that butter with flour and making scones or making shortbread in the same way that I'm now doing it in the kitchen. Yeah, I've never really thought about it like that, but that helps you connect back with your family history and previous generations.
French people feel French when they walk into a local boulangerie and they order a baguette. It's not a big thing. It's a passive ritual, but it's something they esteem themselves through. A New Yorker going into a bagel shop, ordering their bagel, they walk out, they are esteemed by committing that cultural act. It is not highfalutin. It does not require any extra effort. But what it does is it attaches a sense of identity to yourself in your day. And as many things as you can do in a day that make you feel Scottish or that make you feel like you're part of your community, it has impact on you. It makes you feel tethered to your place. People are much less likely to transgress on their community when they feel attached to it. You're much more likely to stop and pick up a piece of trash because you feel belonging to a community. Lots of the work that I do outside of food is around cultural regeneration. So how do we get communities to start recognizing their values, start investing in themselves, start caring about themselves? And food history, because it is accessible, it is relatively high value, low investment, and it actually is real. We can have memories of what our grands did, about what our parents ordered, about the way that we have lived our lives. Food can be a tool for an entire kind of awakening to what Scottishness can be for you.
It makes sense. And when you mentioned the morning roll earlier, I know you've done a bit of work on the morning rolls in the past. What does that mean in terms of Scottish food?
Yeah, I mean, I have been looking for ways in which we can try and like shake people a little bit to wake up to food history, because in Scotland, and I think you'd probably agree with me, is that we tend to have two conversations about food. They are food, which is whiskey and Aberdeen Angus beef and very expensive provenance foods. And we have a conversation about BMI charts and deep fried Mars bars. Often we don't have a conversation about the stuff in the middle, the real stuff, the ritual, the history, the family recipes, the scones, the shortbread, all these sorts of things. They tend to be left to the sidelines. So I've been looking for ways in which things that we can all agree on to be able to kickstart a bit of a debate. And actually, it was through conversations with journalists overseas and down in England about like what is something everyone should try, or what's your favourite Scottish food. And I love morning rolls. I love a crispy roll with a long fermentation and a high quality butter and a local butcher's Lorne sausage or bacon. It's like a vehicle for the very best of Scottish produce, I believe, full-heartedly. But morning rolls have also been sold in this country for 500 years. Over 500 years. For half a millennium, Scots have been walking into a baker and making a decision about what kind of roll do I want today. And so part of what I'm doing just now is about trying to gather community consent from as many Scots as I can by going around the country, and I do a kind of 45-minute presentation on the history of morning rolls. It's all very light and comedic and a little bit of history and a little bit of politics, because you cannot speak about food in history without getting a little bit political, but not too much. And then at the end of it, if people agree that actually, yes, morning rolls are ritual, morning rolls are important to us, they are unique and distinct to Scotland based on the research that I have provided, they then leave their order as they're going out the door on a mic. And in a few months' time, in 6 months' time, I'm going to take those orders and my research and deliver them to UNESCO to be included in the UK Living Heritage Inventory as a piece of intangible culture.
Excellent. Sounds like very important work on the morning roll.
I love treating morning rolls as seriously as we would treat a big old sculpture or a big old Stonehenge or all these things, because really I'm thinking about young people, seniors, people my age, parents, people that live in Scotland. We all need to feel better about being Scottish. There's something at the root of who we are right now that I do believe is changing. People are waking up to our ingenuity and our creativity. But we also, I want young people who feel really disconnected from Scottish culture to realise, if I order a morning roll, I'm participating in a 500-year-old ritual. And when I'm eating that morning roll, I'm probably eating a local baked good with a local butcher good with high quality produce. And not that a morning roll is for every day, but that, you know, that we can, for the cost of £3.50, participate in Scottish culture and be so proud of it that it sits right next to a baguette, it sits right next to a bagel, and a morning roll is older than the first references for both of those things. So let's celebrate it for what it is, really fantastic Scottish food.
Yeah, we've got such a rich history in terms of our food in Scotland. Talking about more morning foods, I want to get on to the kind of mindful eating and focus maybe in on breakfast, because, yeah, we can't talk about all types of foods, but focusing on breakfast in particular, because to be honest, it's my favourite meal of the day. But breakfast is really important because it does break the fast, breakfast. So it's a great opportunity to give your body nourishment and energy and protein and all the micronutrients you need. So nutritionally, it is a really important meal of the day. So I wondered if we could talk a little bit about what our ancestors ate a few generations ago for breakfast. What would their kind of typical breakfast look like in Scotland, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, my text today will, I have two kind of main texts that I use, or two authors that I use. One is Alexander Fenton. He was a gentleman who wrote this textbook called The Food of the Scots in the 90s. It is the most boring textbook you will ever read. It really flattens food as a culture into statistics, but it's really good for kind of being able to see where things like, when did bacon and eggs become a thing? What was the role of oats in the year? Where did people secure their food from? These kind of things. And then I use Florence Murray McNeil. She was an Arcadian food writer who was born in the 1890s, and she wrote a series of books throughout the 20th century all about kind of rural Scottish food history. We kind of think of her as perhaps the first Scottish food historian. And she wrote a book in 1932 called The Book of Breakfasts. And it's a book that's all about Scottish breakfast. It was really for a Scottish market. And at the opening of this book, she details different menus from Scotland's history, different breakfast menus. So in some of my own research, I've been looking a lot at the moment about how can I develop this relationship with meaningful eating by trying to lean back into the foods that my ancestors have eaten. So I began to, all my family history really goes back to Islay and farmers and kind of crofters over there until kind of the 1840s, 1850s, when they came to Paisley and immediately got into industrial work. So I had initially started by looking at some of the menus that my great-great-great-grandparents would have eaten in Islay.
What was the Islay breakfast?
Well, an Islay breakfast, if we go with an island croft, the most popular menu was porridge with milk, fried silex. Silex is a very small fish. It really isn't commercially caught these days. If you go into your fishmonger, they will know about silex and they can give you like the best kind of, I think a pillock is one that you can get quite readily now. Boiled eggs, girdle scones or griddled scones, oat cakes, butter and tea. So quite recently, a couple of months ago, I sat down and had this as a breakfast. And it is it's a lot of carbs, more than I'm used to. It's also such a filling breakfast, like not something, as someone who waits till 11 a.m. to have a bagel, sitting down with porridge, fish, eggs, scones, and oat cakes with butter and tea was a bit of a feat. But yes, the kind of other kind of more kind of closely aligned one as well is a northern manse. But from the research that I've seen, it's quite close to farmhouse eating as well, manse eating. So porridge with milk or cream. Cream really comes in the beginning of the 1900s. Cream is served in almost every meal, and especially if you've got a big dairy industry around you. You then have fresh herring fried in oatmeal or wind-blown whiteys. So that was, you'd string the fish up to a fishing line outside and let it air dry, especially if you're on an island that's got a lot of wind. You boiled eggs, wheaten scones, barley bannocks, oat cakes, butter, toast, tea and marmalade all on your menu.
Wow. Again, quite carb loaded, but I guess people were perhaps more active during the day than we are now.
I mean, what we would probably say historically, well, and what we'll do is a big old caveat that says the lives of the working class and the peasant class in this country have rarely been documented in detail. And so what we rely on, especially in these texts and broader conversations, we rely on things like letters that came from authors. We rely on poetry. We rely on the kind of the artistic interpretation of individual surroundings. And so we're going to make some broad generalizations here, but hopefully based in fact. People weren't waking up and immediately having breakfast. They tended to wake up with the sunrise or with, depending on where you were at in the year, to the call of the animals. And you would then get up and probably do at least an hour of work, of labour, getting the farm set up, getting your day prepared. And in that time, the woman of the house, if you were living as a family unit, we'd get the fire going, we'd get the girdle pan on, and that would be the beginning of like when you come back home, you then have breakfast before you kind of go out for the rest of the day. So yeah, you're actually starting off probably with an appetite already, as you're immediately up, out to work, your body's flexing, your stomach muscles are cramping, you're probably not even having a cup of tea or a drink of water, you're getting into work immediately. And so when you're coming back in, you're going to sit down to a very large meal with lots of carbs, very filling, quite a bit of variety in there as well. I mean, fish, eggs, porridge, there is a variety that's coming in here. And of course, tea, which was a really early adopter in Scotland, especially by the working classes. We loved tea. This is probably the most variety you would have in a day is at breakfast. For the rest of your day, you're probably eating things like kale soups. You're going to be having beef broths. You're not necessarily having a great deal of fiber and meat and things throughout the day. So actually, this initial kind of breakfast is where you're going to have perhaps your tastiest meal, if not also your most filling meal of the day.
Mm-hmm. And there is a good mixture of, say, the protein sources, the boiled eggs and the fish. Great for healthy fats as well. And porridge, a great carbohydrate with cholesterol-lowering properties of the fibre in oats. So yeah, really good. I mean, I never thought about making my own oat cakes. That's something you just go to the supermarket and buy oat cakes these days. But our ancestors would have obviously done that.
Oh, absolutely. And thinking about bannock, kind of a brief bit of context. A bannock is a kind of category of oat bread baking in Scotland. There are hundreds of different varieties. There were varieties for the big feast days, so for Yule, for Martinmas, for every quarter day in Scottish history, they would have a special one that they would, and it might just be a kind of an oat bannock that would then get coated with an egg or be sliced in a certain way to be ritualistic. And we don't really know when they started. These are bannock rituals that have evolved over thousands of years. Well, let's say 2,000 years. But the point being that within these kind of this little community of the breakfast table, you looked for ways to be original. You looked for ways to add variety. And so, yes, you might have your very kind of flat oat cake, a bit like an oat cake that you're used to eating today, but you would also have one that was maybe about an inch or two, and it might be served to you still quite steamy and you could rip it apart. You would used to have some for, I think, called a Rutherglen sour cake, which was a type of bannock, and it would be rolled so thin that if you put it over a fire, it might escape from you and go up with the force of the smoke. So a real variety in there. But actually, I always say to people now, if you're going to have a wee charcuterie evening or you're going to have people over, oat cakes are so easy to make. And they actually, you do taste the difference. And it's very cost effective to make your own. So if you have the time and the resource and a frying pan or a Scottish girdle, a griddle, then give oat cake making a go.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, and try and put my own twist on it as well, just to...
Please.
Do something a bit different. Compared to a scone, so a bannock's denser, but what is the difference between a bannock and a scone?
So, bannocks came first, and bannocks were dominated by oats, barley, and pea flour as the main kind of flours that we can grow in Scotland. In our clay soils, and our very shallow topsoil in the Highlands, these are the kind of the grains and pulses that we can grow successfully. Wheat begins to get imported into Edinburgh, we believe, in the kind of late 1400s, early 1500s. And at that time, we begin to see baked products rise in importance. And in 1515 is the first mention of a scone. It's the Flour Sconess by Bishop Gavin Douglas. And I literally just did a show about scones yesterday for the BBC, so I'll sit in the back of my mind. So scones really are just an adaptation of a bannock, which began to look a wee bit closer to what we know them now in the middle of the kind of 1800s with the kind of the invention of baking soda and baking flour and getting that lift. It became a daintier, delicate bite. But before that, it would have been really a scone. It is just a wheaten bannock.
And then... if you're from Aberdeen or Aberdeenshire, where I'm from, you've got the Buttrays or the Rowies. That's maybe, I suppose there's regional specific foods in different regions, but growing up in Aberdeenshire, it was always the Buttray.
Yeah. It's funny you say Buttray. Is that how you would say it as an Aberdonian? Is it a Buttray?
Buttray, yeah.
I say buttery, but then I'm from Paisley, so I would say buttery because I have to try and pronounce every syllable or it just slurs out my mouth. No, yeah. So what you have is like, In the 1601, we have the first reference of morning rolls, which is a reed bap. And they're being made for breakfast for travelling journeymen. So these were men who were, they were people who were trying to get educated as blacksmiths, as joiners, as carpenters. And there was an expectation that you would travel around the country trying to learn as many different skills in your trade as possible. And so our cities were had this massive influx, especially after the kind of the last dregs of the Black Plague were leaving us, as there was massive skill gaps, shortages. People were flooding into Scottish cities. And at 4:30 in the morning, what are you going to serve? But a small rolled loaf called a reed bap, a ready bap. And this is the beginning of the morning roll. Now, as journeymen are travelling around Scotland, they're taking with them these rolls, and these small morning rolls are becoming the expectation of having access to them to be able to feed yourself. You could fit in your pocket, you could get two of them, you could fill them with ham or cheese or whatever other provisions that you had with you. And then slowly but surely, whatever the local industry is in that area begins to adapt the morning roll. So in the northeast, shipping, fishing was the big kind of industry. And if you're going to go out for a couple of days at a time, or you're going to be in around some very wet environment, you want to have some sort of coating over that roll. And so you take a morning roll and you fold it with lard or butter, and that creates the buttery. In the same way, in Dundee, they had a fishing industry, but perhaps it wasn't about long hauls. And so they have more sugar in their morning rolls because it helped to preserve them and keep them good until evening or until the next day. In the West Coast, where we have access to like semolina, factories were connecting with trade more, with have like kind of things like rice cones. They were used as the dusting, which then created this crispy coat. So wherever the morning roll goes, it meets the industry and the access to ingredients in that part of Scotland. And now we have varieties upon varieties of morning rolls that kind of populate our country. But there's enough now we have in research of Scottish food history that if you tell me where your ancestors have lived in the last 300 years, I can find recipes from that time and that place and allow you to eat with your ancestors. And I think that's a thing that we should all maybe experiment with to see how we can feel connected to not only family and bloodlines, but actually communities. Because communities experience access to resources in the same way. They experience access to industry in the same way, or to food the same way, and lots of the ways that they lived as communities was the same. So actually, if I can feel connected to Islay farmers in the late 1700s, what does that do about my relationship with Scotland and my relationship of feeling like I'm from Islay and my grandparents were from Islay and all those sorts of things? I think it's a tool at the moment for exploring. Do you have any advice about kind of opening up a new food experiment, or things that I should be thinking about with my body or as I'm approaching eating?
Yeah, well, there's lots of different mindful eating techniques. And certainly I talk about mindful eating in a lot of the one-to-one sessions that I do with individuals wanting to improve their diet or improve their relationship with food. So one of the kind of more simple techniques is just pausing before you eat. It's almost like saying grace. Like, I'm sure not many people perhaps say grace these days, but we used to sit down and say grace before starting a meal. And it actually just allowed your body to relax a bit more. Because if you're having a stressful day, you're in that fight or flight mode. And it's much better for your body to digest food if it's in that rest and digest state, that relaxed state. So just by pausing, even for 1 minute, to just do some deep breaths and pause to kind of appreciate what's in front of you and on the plate and think about where it came from, the food story, how it got there, who produced it. Even if it's just for a minute, have that mindful minute moment before you start eating and just connect with how does my body feel at the moment? Am I really hungry? What do I fancy eating? And then, yeah, it's almost like a mindful eating grace I would do for a minute.
I love this. Both the proximity of like saying grace, which is something that my ancestors would have done living in very religious communities, but also that mindful minute, because I don't stop. And actually, if you're sitting at a table or you're putting food on trays, everyone starts eating at different times and you're probably watching television and I'm not even aware when a fork meets my mouth. So no, that is have you trademarked mindful minute yet? Because I think you should get on that.
I'm sure somebody else has, to be honest.
Oh, right, okay.
There's so many times that we eat mindlessly in today's environment, because our environment promotes that. We're scrolling on our phone when we're grabbing lunch, or we're on the way to the train station and we're having something on the go, literally. So just that pause in to think about the foods in front of you. And actually, I think it's Brazilian dietary guidelines, which actually have one of the recommendations is to eat with others as much as possible. And I think that's such a valuable thing to do, is to help you slow down and to help you connect with, you know, what they're doing in their lives, and connect more with others and with the food that you're eating.
Yeah. Breaking bread with people is so important. And it's the next level of, like, once we get past mindful eating and eating with our ancestors, is actually repairing our food systems. And one of the things that we have stopped doing is eating as a community. And historically, communities which ate together survived, because you were able to, A, see when someone is becoming isolated. If you eat with people, you're less likely to transgress against them. If you are seeing somebody might have an ailment, or you might show an early sign of disease. In all of our history, eating together has allowed those people to, A, have access to food, and then to have concern over them. We don't have that these days. And actually, perhaps we didn't feel it as much because people were probably growing up in church communities like I was, where community, or actually you were growing up around a village green, or you were growing up and you had access to three shops in your local place. And so you saw everyone, and people were nosy, but also had concern. We just don't have that anymore. Someone can exist in a remote job, ordering groceries through Deliveroo, and not actually going, you know, can go through a week without having a human conversation that isn't about work. These are really detrimental parts of our society today that do need to be addressed. And actually, the new Public Diners Project, I don't know if you've heard about this.
Yes, it sounds great.
So essentially in World War II, actually perhaps a little before, but the government set up these things called public diners, where you could access low-cost, high nutritious food that would fill you. And essentially it was about saying to people, you don't have to just survive on rations. If you have money to at the end of the week, you can go in and have 13 pence toast and tea. You can afford to come out, because when you can get people to leave the house and enter into a room with other people, it has far greater impact. It's not just about nutrition. It's not just about keeping people fed. It's about reducing isolation and giving people access to community. So there's a new Public Diners Project which is going to start up in Dundee, I believe, in the next few months. I believe that Dundee Student Union got the contract to deliver the actual food and cookery for this program. And they're going to do a bit of research on it to see, what is the impact of public diners? Should we bring them back? Will it have a good impact on our high street by reintroducing people to the act of socialising? I can't wait to go.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting, because our environment that we eat in is so important for our dietary choices and how we feel about food. So yeah, that's an exciting project to look at. I'm going to wrap up a little bit now, just to finish off with, we've talked a lot about breakfast. What is your favourite breakfast, would you say?
I mean, I will say these new, I don't know what to call them, porridge pancakes that I've been having are right up there. I do have a little like agave syrup, and I just enjoy them. There's something very nostalgic about pancakes for breakfast for me, because it was my mum's speciality, and she rarely makes them now, but unless I ask her, but as a 34-year-old, it's very embarrassing. Mum, can you make me pancakes? But anyway, it's got that level of comfort for me, but also it doesn't feel like you're eating sugar. It feels like you feel full, and it ticks all the boxes for me. So that currently, and if not, of course, a morning roll.
Absolutely. Don't expect nothing less. I'm going to try that out myself, actually. Well, thank you so much for your time and all your insights. It has actually been fascinating just hearing about the stories and the history of some of our foods. I'll certainly think about shortbread a lot differently now. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this Food Connections podcast. Do check out the show notes and follow Peter on Instagram at Tenement Kitchen. And check out his own podcast, the Scottish Food History Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be great if you could leave a short review for Food Connections. And if you know someone who might enjoy this episode, please do tell them about it. Also, if you'd like to sponsor the podcast, do get in touch. My email is nutrition@laurawinus.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.